or will be profiling the world's richest man, Elon Musk. Professor Jill Lepore untangles the strange sci-fi roots of Silicon Valley's extreme capitalism and the tech billionaire, Elon Musk, the evening rocket, starts tomorrow at 4 p.m. on Radio 4.
Key events of the 1990s with Robert Carlyle.
You might think Islamophobia only came into existence after the attacks of 9/11. In fact, the phrase was first coined in a report in 1997.
Race relations, Europe, and the rise of lad culture.
One way of interpreting the new lad is as a kind of reactionary move against women's demands.
A new 10-part series looking at the decade's lasting legacy.
The term trolling was coined in 1992. Cyberstalking officially became a crime in 1999.
What really happened in the 90s on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds next Monday to Friday lunchtime at 1:45.
On Radio 4 now, one guest telling three guilty secrets. Time to put another prominent citizen through their paces.
I'm Stephen Mangan. Welcome to The Confessional. In this programme, I've been briefed to send a series of eminent guests on the mother of all guilt trips. I've asked them to bring three of their secret shames to share with me in the confines of my virtual confessional box. Just with me, them, an imaginary booth with paper-thin walls, and everybody listening on a Sunday evening on the radio, or whenever you like on BBC Sounds. What's to worry about? We're discretion itself. Time to meet this week's guest, I think. A BAFTA-nominated actor, writer and director, he's best known for appearing in The Wire. Over a long and varied career, he's had a myriad of meaty roles, including one that I was hoping for myself, but I'm not bitter. He played it very well, and in retrospect, it probably wasn't the right time for a white Nelson Mandela. He also wrote the musical Five Guys Named Moe, after being inspired by meeting a man named Moe and thinking, this guy would make 20% of a great musical. I'm delighted to welcome Clark Peters.
That's a really interesting introduction. I'm sorry that I upstaged you with Mandela.
Mine will have to stay for the benefit of my bathroom mirror only, I think. I was brought up in the Catholic tradition, Clark, and so confession, I suppose I'm no stranger to it. What tradition were you brought up in?
I was brought up in the Church of England denomination, but confessions is something I really don't mind. I don't mind sharing. I think I would have liked to have been forced to sit in one of those little boxes, talking to a complete stranger, telling them all the things that I did wrong, and then bolting out of the box once the last word was out of my mouth. But I am aware of karma and have been for a long time. Some of that stuff still stays with me now today. And I think that that's the effect of karma, so that you don't do it again.
Are you hoping to unburden yourself of a bit of guilt? What are you looking for today from the confessional process?
Well, I was just looking for a really nice time, revisiting some of the adventures I found myself a part of. And I think I do want to unburden some things, you know, particularly because some of the characters are no longer walking the earth, you know, and I would just like to get some closure on some of the things, you know, and apologize, you know, and with hopes that maybe somewhere, wherever they are, they hear me and they will forgive me for my transgressions.
So you think they're gone, but they're not gone, and they may be listening in. The original plan for this series was that we would retreat into an actual confessional box, but obviously, circumstances being what they are, that's not possible, so we'll have to use our imagination. What kind of place would you feel most comfortable making your confession in? Will it be the sort of traditional little curtains and a sliding grill, or are you thinking more of a sort of interrogation setup with a spotlight in your eyes? Which one's going to get the truth out of you, Clark? Is it the gently, or the more harsh approach?
You will tell us everything. You yeah. will speak the truth.
I mean, we could go that way. I mean, I can do that.
I don't know. You know, I guess the confessional box is someplace I've never been, not even as a tourist, in some of the most wonderful cathedrals and churches I've been around the world. I've never really stepped into one of those boxes just to see. But I also know that in that just being alone in silence, that would suffice, because at where I am at this point in time in my life, I feel that there is a greater force that is observing. not interfering, just observing, you know, and it might just be my conscience. So my confession can take place at the side of a lake with just you and I and, you know, and nature.
Your conscience. Excellent. Well, I think it's time, Clark Peters, to tell all. Can I have your first confession, please?
When I was, I guess, about 7, 8 years old, I stole some money from my mother. This wasn't an unusual thing, actually. You know, you'd see a dollar bill and you'd just take it. And if your parents were cool enough, they would just let you get away with it without too much hassle. But on this particular day, I was reaching into my mother's secret place where she hid her money, and I felt the bills. And as I felt the bills, I heard someone coming up the stairs. So rather than vetting through the bills, I just grabbed a whole wad and walked out. I met my friends outside, and our intention was to, you know, get a little bit of money and go up to the local toy store and get some toys and, you know, come on back and just have a day of just playing, you know, as you do. Well, when I got to the store, I realized that it wasn't just one bill, it was a couple of bills, and it wasn't a $1 bill, it was a $20 bill, or two of them. So I figured, oh, okay. Rather than being freaked out, I thought, ooh, I'm lucky, you know. So I bought everybody some gifts, and we went back to our street, and you know, we played with our balsa wood airplanes and kites and all sorts of stuff, you know. A little while later, I get a call to come on into the house, and I go into the house, and my father's there, and he says, do you know anything about this? I said, what? He said, there was a trail of bills from the bedroom down the hall and down the stairs and outside the back steps, and I just wondered, anyone know anything about this? And I immediately said, no, all right? And my father said, well, the bills just didn't just, you know, jump out of the drawer, you know, just do this themselves, you know. What happened? So I said, I don't know, you know. And he called my brother in and he asked my brother, does he know anything about this? And he said, no, he didn't know. And he didn't know. Obviously, he didn't know, right? And so my father said, well, until we find these, you know, find out where this money is, the rest of this money, you guys got to get upstairs and start looking around that room, you know. So we go upstairs in the room, and my older brother looks at me and says, I know you took it, you know. Yeah. I know you took this because I can do it.
How much older than you was he?
He was 5 years older than me.
Okay, so considerably, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah, he was.
He had your number.
Yeah, he was old enough to kick my butt, you know. And I pretended to look around for this money, and so did he. And in our bedroom, we had a clothes hamper for dirty clothes, and it was just a big round barrel that we'd throw our clothes in. And I reached in there, and I pulled out a pair of trousers of his, and I took the change that I had, and I stuffed it in one of his pockets.
Oh, very good. Okay.
I know. And I put it back in the bin, and then I discovered it.
Oh, you know, right. You said, look what I found.
Yes, I did. I don't know where this came from, but look, Dad, look, here's the evidence right here, you know. Oh. And my brother was like, are you kidding? You know?
Yeah.
And so we both got a spanking for that. And I think I got more of a spanking than my older brother because, I'm surprised even now that it was that sophisticated or that I was that cunning or that I was that. It was just all wrong. It was just all wrong. I, you know, and if Tony, if wherever you are, I apologize. And Dad, wherever you are, yes, it was me. And I deserve this spanking that I got, you know, and Tony did not deserve any of that.
It sounds like your dad had an inkling this was your
work. I think that my dad did. And I guess that my brother's face showed true incredulity. It's like, what?
You still feel guilt about it all these years later?
Well, now that this is going public, No, I feel a lot easier now. Yes, I'm not the nice guy that you thought I was.
And Tony and your father are no longer with us, is that right?
Yes, they're no longer with us, sadly, yes.
Would you think you'd have been able to make this confession if either of them were still around?
Oh, yes. I mean, I would long to.
Right.
I would love to. I would feel better for it, number one. Number two, I think we would probably all get a good laugh out of it.
I love the fact that you knew where your mum keeps or kept her money. Whenever I was alone upstairs in the house, I mean, I knew my mum's drawers and their secret places, like the back of my hand. I mean, they were just somewhere you always had a look in. You could see the cufflinks or the little wad of money or the foreign money if they ever had any, you know. And now I'm thinking my children are probably looking in my drawers and I'm suddenly thinking, I need to improve the security in this house.
I know. You know, there's sometimes I go into my drawers and think, I'm sure that I left 50 pounds in there in 5-pound notes, you know, and there's only 35. And I keep thinking,
And meanwhile, your children are walking around with a pile of sweets and candy.
Right. As are their friends.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I like the generosity you showed by buying a whole lot of stuff for other people as well. That, you know.
But the thing is that I'm going to take the change back and hide the change is absurd.
You know, because you can't do anything with the toys, can you? You can't put the toys back. People who steal the Mona Lisa, you know, what are you going to do with it? Now you've got it. Everyone knows that where you got it from. And it's contraband.
Yeah, but you know, my escapades of thievery didn't stop there.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I have to say, you've kicked off, you know, first confession with an actual theft. I mean, it's very impressive. If this is the foothills of where we're going, then I can't wait to see where this ends up. Remember
the Shroud of Turin? Well,
I can now reveal. Yeah. Shergar is in my...
Yes, that's right. Shergar is in the garage.
Is in the garage, right. Let's have your second confession, please.
The second confession, I went back to my hometown in Englewood, New Jersey, and I was going to visit my high school. And on our campus, there was a lake, a small pond, actually, that we would go ice skating on in the wintertime. And I guess I'm somewhere in my late 20s, maybe early 30s. I'm going to visit whatever teachers are left there and to say hello and reminisce. And I didn't expect my reminiscing to lead me to this. They had drained the pond for some reason, and in the pond, there were the skeletons of some bicycle frames.
I'm glad you said bicycles. I don't know where that was going for a second.
Yes.
Skeletons.
There were some skeletons.
Yes.
Yes, in actual fact, no. There was a teacher I'd never really liked at all who just disappeared one day. No, I was walking by and I looked in and, you know, it's like returning to the scene of the crime. I looked in and there were a few frames that looked kind of familiar. They were covered with mud, you know, some of them are rusted, but I knew they were about the same place as far as I could throw a bicycle frame into the pond, around the same distance. Well, for someone who might be listening in the States, if your bicycle went missing around in Englewood, New Jersey, around Teaneck Road or Liberty Road, that was probably me.
And can we get a year, roughly, just in case people are wondering, looking back on their bicycle?
Yeah, it's probably around 1967, somewhere around there.
The pond was drained, and there were a lot of bike frames in it. What were they to do with you?
Well, I'd always seen this particular pond full of water. And when I saw it drained, you know, at the corner of my eye, you feel like That's interesting. You know, you don't know what's poking out of it. You know, it could be just some seaweed. But then I looked again, and they were bicycle frames. Now, when you commit a crime,
I'm taking notes. Yeah,
you know where you stash the booty. And in this instance, my stealing of the bicycles, I needed parts, and I took the frames and I threw them in the pond. I mean, there were lots of frames in there, weren't just mine, but I had a pretty good idea of which ones were mine. There were only three of them that were mine, and there were probably a half a dozen or more in there. I could see where mine had landed, you know, and they landed there maybe 20, 30 years earlier.
Wow. So it's you had stolen a few bikes, stripped them for parts,
mm-hmm.
and disposed of the incriminating, most obvious part of a bike, the frame.
I just needed bits and pieces of the bikes. I didn't need the whole bike, because if I walked around with the whole bike, someone would have known that I stolen it. But so I just needed parts of bikes, like we had centipole brakes, for example, which was a new kind of mechanism. I needed handlebars. I needed gears for the 10-speed bikes, you know, and some people had those things that I couldn't afford, and if the bike was there, I took it.
Uh-huh.
But I wasn't always by myself in this. In one instance, there was one cat who I don't think any of us really liked very much. Lived up on Belmont Street. So if you're listening and you remember your bike missing, it was me and Tommy Haney that stole it. And it's probably sitting at the bottom of Miller's Pond now.
So you were taking bikes and stripping them for parts, and then...
Yes.
And then throwing the frames into the pond.
Yeah.
So this is... This is an escalation from the first confession. We're now...
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just theft. It's like a little cottage industry you've got going.
Yeah.
And what would you do with the bikes? And would you ride them, or would you sell them, or would you...
Oh, no. I was just trying to build a bike, man.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right.
You know, and with that bike, the bike that I wound up making... Tommy and another very good friend of mine, Brian Luke, and I rode 300 miles from Englewood, New Jersey to Cape Cod one summer.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Tommy was a wealthy kid, you know, so he, you know, his mother always got him, you know, a new bike. Brian had inherited his from his older brother, and I had put mine together. You know, I had to improvise, and it was to that end.
Yeah.
It was to that end.
I mean, if this was a movie, we'd have to have you entering and winning the Tour de France or something, wouldn't you, on your bike?
And someone on the side going, "Hey, that looks like
Hang
my...
on a minute. You're too quick for them to catch you."
Right. Are those my centipole brakes? Is that my seat? Is that my handlebars? Where do you get those gears? You know.
You put the change in the first story into your brother's pockets and blamed him. You threw the bike frame into the pond. Were you hoping... to blame the ducks?
Oh, well, I wasn't hoping to blame anyone. I'd never thought that they would ever drain that thing. I don't know what I was thinking. I just wanted to get rid of the evidence, as in the first case. Get rid of the evidence.
You must have felt, I mean, that what must have been some experience going back to the pond and seeing the water gone and the crime unearthed.
If you're walking along, looking around to see if anyone sees what you're seeing.
They always return to the scene of the crime, they say, don't they?
It wasn't a nice thing to do. And if it was your bicycle that I stole and you have children, I will buy them each a bike. But you have to convince me that it was your bike that I stole.
So there might be someone out there who watches you in the film as Nelson Mandela and thinking, he stole my BMX.
No, actually, BMXs weren't out by then.
You know, okay.
These are Schwinn 10-speed racers, you know, with
right.
bull handlebars. And all of those things wound up on a rather antiquated bicycle frame. No one would notice like a centipole brake or some handbrakes or some gears, or even some handlebars. But bikes that say Schwinn, Golden Rider on the side, you know,
Todd's bike. Brian's bicycle.
Brian. How did you know it was Brian's?
Because Because you're riding this new sort of Frankenstein bike you've put together with all these different parts. You're riding it around the neighbourhood where the kids live and where the bikes went missing. So, yeah, you've got to be careful.
Yeah, you do have to be careful. You know, I didn't... that's a really interesting way to put it, the Frankenstein bike. Yeah, it was the Frankenstein bike. You know, and it was taken for a purpose. You know, there was a reason. You know, I wasn't just... being criminal about it, I guess I was. You know, there was a motivation for the need for these parts. But nevertheless, walking by and seeing that graveyard of skeletons, you know, that woke me up.
Confronted by your past, confronted by your sins. Literally rising out of the lake, like
out of the murky, Excalibur. Muddy lake at that.
Yeah. I wonder if the mafia ever go past flyovers when they're being demolished. And well, there's a couple of bodies with concrete boots that I threw in there. Oh dear. Well, thank you very much. That's a fantastic confession. I believe you have one more for me.
I don't know if it's a confession. It does. Involve my brother again. I guess overall, this is a moment of how much I love this man, you know, who is like my hero, I guess. And as a child, although he told me many times that when I was born, I ruined everything for him.
Things were fine till you turned up.
Yeah, virtually, those were his words.
Well, I think we all feel a bit of that, don't we? You're always the youngest until the next one comes along, and suddenly you're not.
That's right.
And that's stolen your crown.
But he's also like my hero, because we would, you know, as children, try to do things that we saw on television, like the routines. You know, we would tap, we would throw each other around, we would try to do the Marx Brothers routines on roller skates. I mean, we would just, you know, we always entertained each other. I think that my debut into show business came when I was about 5 or 6 years old. My father worked for a company who would take their employees on Christmas vacations. We used to go to a place in the Catskills called Grossinger's. Grossinger's was one of the venues on the Borscht Circuit, as it was known then. The Borscht Circuit was a series of restaurants, cabaret rooms, so forth and so on. It was a place that Sammy Davis Jr. performed, you know.
Wow.
Danny Kaye.
You saw them all live?
No, I didn't see any of them. I did.
Okay.
I just knew that this is where this was their stomping ground, and this was the place to be. One day I'm walking through the resort, and there's a dining hall, and the dining hall seated anywhere from 500 to 1,000 people. It was a place that you dressed for dinner, you know, bow ties, suits. But in the afternoon, it was just, you know, people were in there cleaning up and setting things for the evening. And in the center of the room was a grand piano. And I had just learned how to play Jingle Bells on a piano. And it was Christmas time, you know, and I looked in, saw this piano, and I thought, oh, let me just go play that. So I went over to the piano, and I tried to open it, it was locked. And this woman came over and says, what are you doing? I said, I just want to play the piano. And she said, it's locked. I said, yes, I know. She said, I'll go find the key. So I said, okay. So this lady goes off to find the key, and I wait for a little while, and she doesn't come back, so I leave. This lady turned out to be Jenny Grossinger, whose family owned this resort. So I forgot about it. You know, that evening, we're all sitting at dinner, and you can imagine the hall, the clatter of cutlery and conversation, just like a din. You know, then someone taps a microphone, and they all the blowing, all that 1-2, 1-2. I can have your attention. Silence. And there's this announcement that goes, ladies and gentlemen, we have a young man here who would like to entertain you this evening with the piano, and his name is Clark. Clark, where are you? Would you come down? And she's calling my name, so I get up and I walk down, right? My father, in his telling this story, was he turned to my mother and says, "When did you learn how to play piano?"
So, but you go to the stage. What are you thinking at that point?
I'm thinking I'm going to play Jingle Bells.
Okay.
All right. So I get up there and silence. Oh. I have a physical memory of the excitement of this attention of people focused for a moment, and they're focused on this little boy that's walking up to a piano expecting to hear something. And I get to the piano and I sit down, and the lady says, "And what are you going to play for us this evening?" And I said, "I can't play without my brother." And she goes, "Oh, isn't that cute? Okay, it's his brother here." And my brother Tony gets up and comes and sits down next to me.
Oh, good on Tony.
You know, so now there's a little bit of a giggle, and you know, we're sitting there side by side, and she says to him, "And what are you going to play?" And he says, "I can't play without my music." She says, "Well, I think there's some music in the piano bench." So we stand up while she looks in the piano bench to find the music. And while that's happening, I go back and sit down and wait. And a little while later, my brother joins me and sits down.
Oh, great. You've had your thrill and you're just out of there.
Even now, although I can't see the details of the moment, whatever the experience was, is somewhere in my being, and it just makes me smile and feel good. And it was innocent, yeah. And I know that that was a seed for wanting to perform.
I mean, what I love about that story you told is the sense of, it's almost shamelessness. Did you think, I better not do Jingle Bells because it's not good enough for this crowd and it'll ruin the moment? Or do you genuinely need the music?
No, I didn't need the music at all. I actually think that I was overwhelmed by the people. Look at all these people. Look at all these eyes. Feel all of this. You know, when you have a captive audience. This is the journey that I've been on, you know, from sitting down at that piano and saying, I need my brother to sit down with me.
I need to be part of a gang up here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, of course, there's nothing worse than getting all those people together in a room, you know, and the evening not panning out. You know, that's tough. Whew. To be in a room where things are not going according to plan.
Yeah, but, I've been in one of those rooms.
Let's not upset ourselves too much. Every actor's nightmare. Well, I think that's a fantastic place to wrap it up, and partly because the phone here is ringing off the hook with people from New Jersey who've just found out what happened to their childhood bike.
Oh my God. Well, listen, don't give them my number. As a matter of fact, hello, is anybody there? I can't hear you.
Oh, Clark Peters, thank you so much for visiting The Confessional.
Thank you, dude. Thank you very much. It's been a real gas.
This was a 7 Digital production for BBC Radio 4, with some extra jokes by Nick Doody and production by Dave Anderson and Frank Sterling. Ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Mangan has left The Confessional.